UK-based initiative, Powerful Women, together with Bain & Company, has released the 2025 State of the Nation report, which analyzes female representation in leadership roles within the UK's energy sector. While some progress has been made in middle management, overall, progress seems to have stalled, revealing a significant gap in female representation in the top decision-making roles. In some cases, the 2025 stats show the diversity needle hasn't budged one bit over the past year. To learn more about the report findings and what this could potentially mean for the UK's energy sector, I had the opportunity to speak to Monica Collings, Chair of Powerful Women. Monica was recently awarded an OBE for her work in the field of gender diversity and unpacks why diversity simply cannot be ignored, why a more inclusive workforce is good for business and absolutely essential to support the UK's energy sector revolution. It was a refreshing, candid, and thought-provoking conversation that highlights why women in leadership is more than merely a tick box affair, but one that could potentially have profound, positive impacts if implemented correctly. I'm Pamela Larg, and this is the Energy Transitions Podcast. Monica, thank you so much for joining me today. It's great to have you on the show. And I think we're talking about something that is so critical, and yet it seems to be a continual challenge. And that's the issue around women in power and diversity. But before we get into the nitty-gritties of the topic, first of all, tell me about Powerful Women and your role as the new chair. First of all, congratulations on that role.
Thank you. Thanks, Pam. So, yes, I took up the position last month to chair the Powerful Women Board, taking over from Katie, who I know that you have spoken to previously. And it's a great honour. It's an organisation that I have been incredibly passionate about supporting as an ambassador up to this point. And I think really leveraging on my own lived experiences and using those to help shine a spotlight and give a voice to many women from across the sector. And that's what it's really been about. That, for me, is the opportunity to use my voice and inspire and help others to use theirs to advance progress for women across energy and utilities.
But this is not the first time that you will be using your voice to really advance the cause. And apparently you have been recognized recently by some rather important people in this regard. Tell us a little bit more about that, because that is very exciting.
It is so exciting. And it's such, it's such a surprise. And I'm very overwhelmed by all the messages of support that I've received since Saturday, when the King announced in his birthday honours list that I was to receive an OBE for all of the work that I've been doing to support diversity within the energy sector. So an amazing accolade. And I think what I found most humbling is the amazing reach of the message and the support that I've had since that was announced. And people talking about their own experiences and listening to the many messages that have come in, I can really see that there is a role for powerful women to take moving forward to help continue empowering those women to use their voices. When I was talking to the organisation about taking on the chair role, part of what I said in my interviews was that I didn't want to be silenced. I've been quite vocal about this issue, and I didn't want to have to toe any party lines or stop sharing my own experiences, because I think by us leaning into some of that and really embracing what we have experienced and using that to shine a spotlight perhaps on some of the barriers that still exist and allow organisations to really understand the needs women have within their workplaces, that's where the real magic happens in terms of accelerating that progress. So I sort of said to them in a jokey way, just be careful what you wish for if you appoint me chair. And so I have continued to be a spokesperson, but not really because I intend to use it in an egotistical way, just more that actually I think it's something that we need to continuously come back to when we're talking about the sector, the green skills that we need to attract, and also the fact that we have almost 500,000 roles that are going to be created in order to deliver the energy transition, and to do so in a fair and just way requires us to include women in that conversation in key decision-making positions. And so it's something that, as you can tell, I feel very passionately about, and I do feel like throwing my weight and my voice behind it helps others to feel like they can share their experiences and do the same.
Powerful Women is looking to achieve 40% of energy sector leadership and middle management roles to be held by women by 2030. Now, I realize that work has been done and progress has been made, but how are we actually tracking in terms of reaching this goal?
If I were to summarize, we are within reach if companies step up and act fast and act together to really prioritize the focus around delivering that ambition. But if we don't, then we won't get there. We just won't. We launched the 2025 Powerful Women State of the Nation recently. And in that report, it's a bit of a mixed bag. There are some highlights in terms of progress, but at a snail's pace, I would say. We are seeing incremental gains rather than transformative level of change. The report pulls data from the top 100 energy companies, and those companies employ around 230,000 people between them. So it is a pretty solid snapshot of where things stand as the data set goes. Bain & Company supported us with the analysis of that data. And my sort of overarching observations on it, which I'm sure we'll get into the specifics of talking about, is we've got 5 years to go to reach that target. What we need is decisive structural change, especially in the way in which we look at inclusive hiring, mentoring, culture building, and really ensuring that we're not just filling a hopper for women to fall out the bottom of. Actually, we are putting them into environments where they can be successful, be retained, and have meaningful contributions through career-defining moments.
You briefly touched on some of the results of the report, but can you give us a little bit more detail? Were there any particularly exciting or particularly worrying results in the state of the nation?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me take you through it. So women now make up 30% of board members, and that's up just 1% from last year, and 16% of executive directors, which is only up 1% as well. So that's the snail's pace of progress. Middle management saw the most movement, rising to 34% female representation. So what we're starting to see there is a stronger future pipeline building, and Powerful Women's Leaders Coalition has done quite a lot of work in that area. So I think the fact that we're seeing a slightly larger improvement, I mean, still only a couple of percent, but slightly larger, demonstrates the fact that actually when you do shine a spotlight, you do start to see that effort translate into results. We still have serious gaps though. 15% of companies have no women on their boards. And the most striking number, I think, is that 73% have no female executive directors at all. 73% of the top 100 employers have no female executive directors. If you look at the two key roles, so the CEO and the chair role, only 8% of CEOs and 9% of board chairs are women. So when I was a female chief executive, that number was only 4%. So we are seeing progress in some of those roles. And actually in the last 2 years, we've seen accelerated progress, but we're still below 10%. It's actually interesting that the CFO role has the highest female representation, with women holding 16% of those positions. I think the most depressing figure, though, if we're talking about lowlights, is at leadership level, figures are stalled. So only 34% of roles are filled by women, and that's exactly the same as it was last year. And that hints that really we're not seeing any sort of recent progress and that we're running out of steam potentially. So I think there is a lot more that companies can do to bring women into the fold and hold on to them. But really, it's about the level of intent and the level of pace in order to achieve those targets. And if we're talking about momentum, then I think we need to look at whether we need a serious boost to that.
You mentioned the need for decisive structural change. What has been preventing us from actually activating this change? And what do we need to do, Monica, to really ensure that this change happens?
I mean, there's plenty of inspiration if we go looking elsewhere for organisations that have done this and delivered it successfully. The FTSE 350 has already achieved 40% by 2025, which is what they set as their ambition behind them in terms of our target. Structurally, the energy sector has historically been a male-dominated or traditionally male-dominated sector. And some of the environments that were created were just never designed for women. Believe it or not, I still go and visit sites and find that there are no sanitary bins in female toilets, which is astounding because it is a basic fundamental human need. It is a female need. And I've talked to young women who are early on in their careers but then are in those situations where they need to use those provisions and then can't, and then have to worry about how they're going to leave that bathroom, walk out into a corridor in an environment dominated by men, and then struggle to dispose of their waste appropriately. You know, no one should ever have to think about that in the workplace. And I think that is, you know, it might not be that that is the situation in every environment that those companies have employees within, but even down to, you know, flexible working and the way in which we view flexible working and perhaps some of the biases that are still attached to what we believe to be the real benefits or perceived benefits around adopting flexible working practices. Having zero tolerance for discrimination and harassment. I mean, some of the experiences that I had in my former chief executive role were what I would call utterly unacceptable behaviours. And if those things happened to me, then you can guarantee that they do happen to other women across the sector who are not in perhaps quite a senior position to be able to use their voice to champion change. We report on gender pay gaps, but yet they still exist. You know, we don't necessarily have fair pay and transparent policies. Has it become a bit of a tick box exercise? Actually, do we need government to lean in and support structural change on pay, not just within the work environments? Again, you come back to some of those more basic human needs. Mothers returning from maternity who have the need to express milk shouldn't have to perch on toilets and lean elbows on sinks to try and get comfortable. Actually having a facility, a provision that enables them to comfortably do what they need to do so that they can be full participants in the workplace. Some of these sort of pro-women policies are really about ensuring that women's contribution can remain valued and valuable and that their needs are met from workplaces and organisations. And I think if we can do that successfully, then we stand a better chance of then allowing those women to develop their careers, have meaningful contributions, and also ensure that when we're delivering the energy transition, we do so in a way that ensures we represent customers and communities and that we take everyone on the journey. And it's those diverse perspectives that are going to help us with all sorts of things, whether that be better decision making or innovation and creativity around the way in which we tackle problems.
It's, you know, it still shocks me when I hear things like this, where something that seems so intuitive and obvious. I mean, it's not because I'm a woman. It's so logical that these things would be required in these workplaces to foster an environment and a culture that makes women feel at home and welcome. One can't fathom that we're still in this age where things aren't being provided that should be. And you know, Monica, you mentioned that you had personal experiences as well. And I would assume that that has really fueled your fire and your passion for the work that you do, because, you know, you've been on the receiving end of this.
Yeah. And look, I've written a lot about on LinkedIn about this, because actually, often as women, if we are exposed to situations where we feel uncomfortable because of either inappropriate behavior, or we feel that we are in a situation where we are marginalized, because it's not always about facing behaviors that are inappropriate, but it can sometimes be that you are the only woman in the room and you may struggle to get your voice across, or that the allies that you have there are limited in their impact to encourage you to use that voice. There's a woman that I spoke to recently, and she had an amazing way of describing this. And she said that when she was the only woman in the room, it took up space in her brain because she felt marginalized and there was no one else that looked like her. And if she wasn't busy thinking about that, she would be able to focus on the contribution that she was making in the conversation, but she was very self-conscious. Now, you could argue that that is self-limiting and that that's all in her head, and it is, you know, and that everyone in the room wanted her to contribute and that no one would ever say that they were not inclusive. But actually, sometimes in those environments, if you've got a group that is violently agreeing and they are taking the conversation in a particular direction, and just because of who you are and your lived experiences, you have a different perspective that you want to share, how can you convey that in a way that you feel comfortable? So this woman described that she was not only thinking about what she wanted to say, she was thinking about how she could get into the conversation when everyone was violently agreeing. How could she actually project her voice? How could she do it in a way that didn't disrupt but added to the conversation? And she was feeling anxious about being the only one and thinking in that way. So there is a point about critical mass, and we talked about it at the State of the Nation launch last week, that sometimes these women become poster girls in their organizations, not because they want to be, but almost because they have to take on this characteristic that says, I'm a female leader, I'm paving the way for the next generation, I'm sending the ladder back down to bring these women back up and develop them, and I'm challenging the policies that exist to make things better so that they don't have to go through what I've been through. And so there's almost a way of evolving the situation, but somebody has to go first. I think on a lot of the boards that I sit on, I am the only woman. And it's not that I've ever felt uncomfortable in that situation, because I think you do get to a point in your career where actually you feel a bit more comfortable about it. But some of those lived experiences do shape the way in which you go into those conversations. And within organisations that I've previously led, we had employee resource groups, which are valuable to give women safe space to have conversations and explore some of these things. And I would bring some of these examples in that I'd experienced in this safe space and say, okay, let's talk about how you would respond in this situation. If you were faced with somebody inviting you to sit on their knee inappropriately, and they were more senior than you, and you didn't know what to say, how could we approach that? How could we do that in a way that you feel is safe, that isn't going to harm your career, that makes you feel safe in that context? What could you do? Who could you rely on? What phrases could you use? And almost sharing some of those ideas so that for women who would then find themselves in that situation, because unfortunately it still does happen, you then arm them with knowing that there are things that they can do and ways that they can respond that isn't going to mean that they have to say nothing and not use their voice, or just accept that these practices are okay, because they're very far from it, Pam.
Thank you so much for explaining that to me and to our listeners, Monica. I think it's something that we often take for granted. Well, I certainly do, because I don't think about how much headspace is required when one is in that situation. And like you say, that could be dedicated to all kinds of other exciting things, but rather it isn't, because of the environment and the culture that these women are facing. While I would love to delve into that in a lot more detail, I would like to touch on some of the more practical questions. And I think the first thing that I'd like to ask you is that the UK is obviously facing a number of challenges and opportunities within the energy sector. Why is it so important that we have women in leadership positions? And then I think my next question is, how do we ensure that women can actually use their headspace more effectively when they find themselves in these positions?
Yeah, I mean, look, the UK energy sector is a fundamental driver of growth, right? It's core to the government's strategy to grow our economy. We recognise that the energy transition is really significant in the role in which it will play in delivering net zero. We have a huge amount of momentum that has built up across all parts of the energy sector, and that is decarbonising and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. It's, you know, renewable energy integration and bringing in more renewable sources of power so that we can contribute to that decarbonisation. It's ensuring that we can meet the rising demand, particularly with things like the shift to electric vehicles and heat pumps that is expected to increase demand, I think, by over 50% over the next couple of decades. We've got ageing infrastructure, and we are going to need to evolve and modernise to meet future needs. And all of that's happening alongside what can only be described as significant geopolitical uncertainties, whether that is, you know, the threat of war and market fluctuations, supply disruptions, all sorts of things that are affecting our ability to deliver on that. And so we are in a modernizing, transformative time. It's a revolution, really, and we are leaning into that in a way that will be unrecognizable, and we are reimagining the way in which this sector totally appears. And if we look back on where we have been, the sector has been very focused on infrastructure and engineering and delivering very solid practical solutions. But if we lean into the issues of today, we have affordability challenges. We have, you know, more than, if depending on which definition you look at, 10% of people living in fuel poverty. We have an energy transition that relies on us delivering low carbon technologies, but we also have people that can't afford to pay their energy bills, let alone invest in the technologies that are going to help them with enjoying the benefits of lower cost bills that are needed, the LCTs that are needed to deliver that. And we need organisations to collaborate in a way that has never happened before, moving our energy system from being a one-way system to a two-way, where the flow of energy is back and forward, with consumers turning into prosumers and all of those changes happening. And we're designing it. We're designing it now, and we're bringing people on that journey. And I guess for me, you know, there's the silver lining out of the crisis in Ukraine and the energy crisis that we all experienced over the last few years has been that people are much more aware of energy than they ever have been before, ever, ever, ever. And it, you know, we sit at our Christmas dinner tables and we talk about energy, we talk about our electric vehicles and how we've cooked our turkeys, and we talk about the cost of energy. And I think that we are almost on that cusp of a tipping point of being able to really gain traction and a movement to bring people along. Why then does diversity matter? Well, Because if we are now in a world where we have to think of not energy just as an essential service that is delivered one way, we are now in a transformative space, a bit like the banks went through with open banking and all the data being made available and putting power back to the consumers, where consumers will have a greater role to play in this future energy sector. They will have a role in terms of flexibility, amongst other things. And therefore, they need to be fully engaged. We need to understand their needs. We need to meet those needs brilliantly. We need to take our consumers on a journey with us. And that requires us to have people who think customer first. We need the engineers, don't get me wrong, but we also need a new skill set that has never really been fully embedded within this energy system in a way that will help us to deliver this transition successfully and equitably by bringing everyone on the journey. And that whole just and fair energy transition is super important. So we need the people that can do that. Those people are going to spearhead innovation. They're going to improve enhanced decision making. They're going to strengthen this workforce by bringing in and addressing skills and skills shortages and fostering more resilience in what we're trying to deliver. And I absolutely believe that we need women in that mix to do that successfully, to drive more equitable policies, because let's face it, you know, there is a disproportionate impact on women who take up more caring responsibilities. That we know in from data points in other countries that women will go without food themselves in order to feed their children. In war-torn countries, there is a disproportionate impact on women who are left trying to make ends meet for the families that are left behind. And so we understand that without having fully representative workforces, those views are not represented within the room and in the conversations. And so I suppose my summary is, it's good for business, it's good for customers, it's good for everyone to have these more diverse workplaces, because we will leave no stone unturned and what we build will be better and stronger if we do it together.
Well said, very wise words indeed. Monica, do you think we need to look at potentially reframing the whole DEI conversation, possibly looking at more outcomes-based principles and re-emphasizing fairness? Is that something that's needed?
So I think we can get very caught up on labels. We can talk about DEI and we can get very animated about the fact that we're seeing policies change in different countries, and that is driving global shifts in how we see diversity, equity, and inclusion within the way in which those companies adopt policies. I take a slightly different view on it now that I'm a sort of portfolio board director, in that we are looking for companies to be sustainable. And ESG is really high up on the agenda. We want organisations that are responsible, that are socially conscious, and that deliver the right outcomes for customers and communities. It's really important, and shareholders recognise that. DEI is part of that. However you budget, however you frame it, whatever you call it, having inclusive workplaces where we have stronger representation for women helps us shape sustainable solutions. So I'm going to lean on an example, not from the energy sector, but I do some work in education, and parents got very animated about DEI and about woke agendas and about driving forward what DEI initiatives were being adopted. And we took a step back and said, actually, what do we want for our children in this educational setting? Actually, what we're looking for is for them to feel a strong sense of belonging. We want them to belong. We want them to feel like this is a place where they are happy, and therefore their educational outcomes will be better. Because if you're happier and a happy learner, you do better, right? It's that's it. And when you frame it in that way, parents don't argue with you. They can't say they don't want their children to be happy and that they don't want them to belong at school, because they do. They want them to feel like this is a place they belong. So we threw out the DEI strategy and we reframed it as a belonging strategy. And it was pretty much all the same stuff, right? Nothing really changed fundamentally. But with that new lens, what it allowed us to do was to get sharper on what were the initiatives that we were trying to drive that meant that everyone benefited, not just particular groups and represented, you know, from different represented groups and characteristics that were protected. Actually, this is just about, on a human level, how can we create an environment that works for people? And it's been brilliant because we've had lots of support for what we're trying to do. We've had voices represented in children's forums where they've shared their thoughts about what belonging means. We've had parent groups come together and talk about what belonging means. And we've had the teaching and support staff come together and share their experiences. And it's allowed us to create a values-based behavioural framework that everyone can buy into. And if we translate that into the workplace, it's exactly the same, right? We want people to feel like they belong and that everything that we are doing is outcome-focused on creating inclusive environments. And Pam, I'll tell you one example of translating that into the workplace, right? I was talking to somebody who, and it required them going through an interview process to have lots of accurate information to help them with understanding when they were going to interview who they were meeting, what the structure was, what the hierarchy was, and they needed an org chart. Now, I don't think any of us could say that when we go for an interview for a job, having an organisation chart presented to you wouldn't be helpful. It benefits everyone, right? So it's not about that person has autism and they need an org chart. It's as part of our recruitment process, why don't we just make sure everyone gets a pack of information and it has an org chart in it? So some of those very small, simple steps that we can take as organisations are for the greater benefit of many. And I think if we get caught up and hung up on DEI as a label, we're missing the point completely.
Monica, how would you describe yourself as a leader? How would you describe your leadership style?
You should probably ask those who I have led, but I would say I try and be as authentic as possible. What you see is what you get. I spent a long time early on in all my career, I've worked in very male-dominated environments, not by choice or design, but I spent a lot of time earlier in my career adopting male characteristics to fit in. And if you're trying to pretend to be something that you're not, it's quite hard work. And my style as I grew older and perhaps started to go through menopause and got a bit more comfortable with who I am and where I'm at in my life, is to be genuine and authentic and comfortable in my own skin. And I always lead with kindness. And that's not about being nice. It's just recognizing this human level that we have a connection and a responsibility as a leader, because I genuinely believe it's one of the greatest privileges to make sure that we look after the people that we are responsible for. So I would say firm but fair. I think I've led through a lot of adversity through my career. And so it's also that I am a purpose-based leader. I create a destination and a vision for something. And then I paint that picture and people can very quickly decide whether they want to be part of that journey or not. And then if they're on it, they know what is expected of them, the values that we all align to, and we all go together.
My personal opinion is that that is the kind of leadership we need to actually ensure our energy transition continues and continues at pace, because it's a people transition. And, you know, just to hear you say that you lead with kindness is very impactful. And I think, it just makes sense, you know, and I think we need more of that perhaps in our world today.
We need to make some really tough calls and some tough decisions at the moment. And that requires leaders to be strong and determined and decisive, but it doesn't mean you can't be kind. And I see it often that we have an image of what it takes to be a CEO or a chair, and we think about, you know, strong, almost these big egos that fill a room. Actually, leaders that listen well and understand and seek to understand before, you know, taking those big decisions are the ones that I believe will help us to do this in the right way. And therefore, you link it back to what Powerful Women is trying to do by bringing the sector's top leaders together. It's about mobilizing that movement so that we can deliver this change in a way that ensures that we are not leaving anyone behind, but also that there's no unintended consequences, that we're not making decisions that then all of a sudden we find, oh, I didn't realize that would happen. But you know what? If you had a woman in the room, maybe they'd have thought about that.
One final question. What are you reading at the moment or listening to, or where are you finding inspiration to keep your drive, or should I say, to keep your passion and drive ignited?
Oh, so I'm working on a bit of a passion project at the moment, Pam. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that because it's consuming all of my listening and reading space. And there's a lady who works in the DEI field. Her name's Wendy Ramshaw, and she's absolutely brilliant. And she and I are collaborating on a book. So we're writing a book. It's not my story or our story. It is the story of women across the sector. So we have been busy interviewing people to share their experiences. And what that's allowed us to do is develop 10 themes that we believe are the biggest blockers and barriers to progress, and for us to listen to their stories and then put practical tips together to help organizations to break down some of those barriers. So we have now completed pretty much all of the interviews. We've got a few more to do. It is mostly women, but there are some men that we've interviewed too to help us with that balance and that perspective. And reading transcripts and listening to the recordings over and over to help us really get sharp on the chapters, the stories that we want to elevate, and how we can be really helpful and practical. So look, it's a bit of a plug because the book only needs writing first, but once it's available, hopefully people will read it and support the cause, and it will do some good to support the energy transition. But the stories are amazing, Pam. There are some fantastic people who are, even despite facing some of these barriers, pushing through and delivering great outcomes for people. And if they just didn't have to fight quite so hard, I just can't imagine what we'd be able to achieve. It's just, these are the real inspiring women, not me. So my OBE is in recognition and in awe of all of them, because they are all challenging and battling on a daily basis. And if I can help by using my platform to elevate their voices, then it will be worthwhile.
We certainly will be keeping an eye open for that book, because I would personally like to read it, and I'm sure that many of our listeners would too. So please do keep us posted. But Monica, what a pleasure it has been to speak with you today, and just for hearing your insights and your wisdom, and yeah, just learning more about who you are as well. So thank you so, so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Pam.
And to all of our listeners, thank you for joining us. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Energy Transitions Podcast, brought to you by Enlit and Friends. That's a wrap from me, Pamela Log, and our producer, Kamo Motse. We hope you can join us next time. Visit enlit.world or subscribe for more episodes.